Welcome to the Influence Podcast, a collection of inspiring and challenging conversations aimed at empowering the entire spectrum of church leadership. I'm George P. Wood, executive editor of Influence Magazine and your host. In today's podcast, I'm talking to Carl Vaders about how to lead a small church. Carl is a longtime personal friend and Assemblies of God minister and the author of Small Church Essentials, Field-Tested Principles for Leading a Healthy Congregation of Under 250, published by Moody. My conversation with Carl Vaders is coming up after a brief word from our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by My Healthy Church, distributors of Voyage, Trusting Jesus in Uncharted Waters. The journey of life may not be predictable or safe, but remember, God never wastes a voyage. In Voyage, Kay Burnett will show you how God calls each believer to step off the dock and relish every moment with Him. With keen insight and practical application, Kay reminds us to trust in God, our captain. It's time to let go of the helm and hold on to Him. Your voyage awaits. Now available in audiobook and print. To find out more about Voyage, visit myhealthychurch.com/voyage today. And now, Carl Vaders. Welcome to the Influence Podcast, Carl.
Great to be with you, George.
So you and I, just for background for our listeners, you and I go way back to the in the Southern California network of the Assemblies of God. In fact, if memory serves, you were my presbyter for a number of years in our particular district presbytery. So it's good to reconnect.
Yeah, it was. That was a little over 20 years ago, so it is going back a little bit.
Back when we were both young, right?
Yeah, we were younger, and we both probably had, I don't know, more hair or less gray hair, at least.
Yeah, I'm with you on both of those. So anyway, we're not here to talk about the good old days. We're here to talk about an agenda or some insights for small church leadership. And you have just, or Moody has just published your book, Small Church Essentials. And I really wanted to talk to you about this because I found it such a hopeful, helpful book about how to lead a small church. And here we're defining a small church as a church under 250 attendants. But in the book, you talk about the backstory to why you came up with these insights about leading a small church. And the book grew out of a long personal frustration with the way that we usually talk about church growth. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about the backstory to this book?
Yeah, I mean, I've been pastoring now for 25 years in Orange County, California. So, you know, this is the place where, you know, Rick Warren tells in his book, Purpose Driven Church, that before he went to Saddleback, he studied the best place in America to grow a large church. And that's why he ended up in Orange County. And I came a few years after him, and it was in the middle of the church growth boom. And I read all the books and I went to all the conferences and I did everything that I was supposed to do. And the church just didn't have the kind of growth that it was supposed to have. And I didn't have the quote unquote excuse of being in a small or rural area that didn't have a big population. Because that's about the only time I would ever hear somebody who'd say, it's okay if your church isn't big, if you're in a small town, because you don't have the population for it. That was like the only way you were allowed to get away with having a small church without being ashamed of it, kind of a thing. Right. And here I am, you know, in Orange County, California, there are, you know, 10 million people within an hour's drive of my front door, probably. So it's not lack of people. And it wasn't lack of trying, and it wasn't lack of prayer, and it wasn't lack of effort, and it wasn't lack of education. But somehow it just wouldn't push past those markers that everybody says should happen if you do all of that. So I started getting frustrated with all of that. And in the middle of all that, I would be at district council with you, now called our network council in Southern Cal. And every year they'd give the state of the district address. And every year part of that was saying how many churches were of what size. And so there's no judgment intended. This is part of the information that needs to be shared among us. And one of those pieces of information was that 90% of our churches were under 200 people and 80% were under 100. But then the feeling after that, that at least I got, was, oh no, they're defining a problem for me. And I'm part of the problem because my church for many years was under 100. And for virtually the entire time I've been pastoring, it has been under 200. And so I sat there for many years with this kind of an, oh no, there must be something wrong with us doing that, and worked really hard to overcome what I perceived to be a massive problem and what I'm continually told is a problem if we can't break these barriers. And then I got to the point where I got so upset and so angry about it and so hurt about not being able to do it that I moved from, oh no, to, oh, so what?
Yeah.
My church is small, big deal. Like the subtitle of the book, it says for a congregation under 250. And every once in a while, I'll still hear from somebody or see somebody comment on social media, under 250, man, try under 50. Well, under 250 includes under 50, so relax.
Right.
First of all. Right. But secondly, yeah, under 250, once you hit over 200 or 250, the dynamic of the church really does change. And we just don't hear a lot about how to pastor well under that area. But what I began to discover was, in my kind of so what zone was, I began to realize there are actually more churches under 50 than we realize. I mean, that's 65 or 75 or so is about the median size. Like half of our churches are under 65 or 75. So we got a whole lot of small in the church, not just in the Assemblies of God, but in the church at large. And so I sat with that kind of so what kind of cynical, hard attitude for probably longer than I should have, until I finally shifted one day and went, well, wait a minute. My church is under 200. Instead of thinking, so what if I thought, now what? What do I do with this? It's kind of like the Moses moment. God says, look at the rod. What have you got? Look at the rod in your hand. Can I do something with that? And that was what changed everything for me, was I went from so what to, okay, now what? What am I going to do with the rod God gave me?
And I almost think that that insight is alone almost worth the price of the book. Because, you know, I think in talking with pastors, and I've been an associate pastor for the vast majority of my career. I was a senior pastor for 3 years, and I was, you know, church under 200 too. You know, when I talk to pastors of small churches, one of the notes that I hear a lot is frustration, and not just frustration, but I don't want to say the feeling of being dumped on, but they kind of feel either guilty or ashamed, or that their ministry hasn't been successful or something like that, and they can get caught in that sense of despair and hopelessness. And yet this insight that you have that, yeah, we're a small church. Now what do we do? That was such a turning point, it seems, for you, that it really opened up consideration and reconsideration of all this leadership stuff.
Yeah.
But it's also such a attitude is such a valuable part of any ministry. And no matter what your church size is, but especially if your church is under 250, it seems like the now what is so important, because instead of saying, well, I can't really do anything until I'm such and such a size, you can say, I can do lots of things given the size that I am. I mean, am I getting the sense of the change that took place in you, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're drilling into it exactly. It was a huge moment. It came across in our church, starting with our leadership team, with me going to them and saying, okay, we got to stop thinking like a big church. And their jaws just about hit the floor. And I said, because we're not one. We're trying to act like something that we're not. If we get big, then we'll think big. If we get to 200, we should be thinking about what would it be like to be 300 or 400. But let's not be sitting here at the time, 120 people, whatever it was, and be thinking like a church of 500, because the systems for a church of 500 don't work in a church of 120. So we got to stop thinking like a big church. We're a small one. Let's ask ourselves, what does a healthy small church look like? And the room was crickets. We were just staring at each other, including me. I didn't know what the answer was to what does a healthy small church look like. And then I started looking around and going, finding the numbers of churches that were small, which is, you know, 90% of the churches in the world under 200, 80% under 100, at least within our, you know, network at the time. And I'm looking at it and going, how is it that the majority of materials on the shelf for pastors doesn't help us to pastor a church under 200 when 90% of us are doing that particular job? And the only reason I'm writing my books is because I couldn't find my books. I had to go and scramble for material. I felt like, you know, Ruth in the book of Ruth, gleaning into the corners, and I'm begging for a Boaz to drop some handfuls on purpose for me.
Right, right.
You know, because it is, it's that hard to find the principles, but it shouldn't be that hard. It should be front and center of everything we do because most of us are pastoring in that situation.
Yeah, so one of the key principles that you teach in the book is what you've just said, is most of our church growth leadership lessons are drawn from big church examples. But big churches require a different form of leadership than small churches do. And this is largely because of what you call the law of large numbers. So can you explain what the law of large numbers is? And then with that in mind, explain why it is the different sized churches need different types of leadership.
Sure. Yeah, the law of large numbers is a sociological phenomenon that we see every day, but we seldom notice. And it goes simply like this. The larger the group, the more predictably it behaves. And the smaller the group, the less predictably it behaves. This is the premise behind any national survey, for instance, has ever been taken. When Gallup or Pew or Barna does a survey of the nation, they don't have to talk to every single person in whatever group they're dealing with. You just have to have a minimum sample size. But the minimum sample size can't be 20 people or even 200 people. It has to be in the thousands. Because when you're dealing with smaller groups of people, individual opinions can skew the numbers so much that you can't scale it up. So you've got to have a minimum sample size. And so most of the teaching that we get about how to pastor well is coming from pastors of large churches. And I don't think that's bad or wrong. They're the names we know, so they're the names that we're willing to pay the money for to hear at a conference. And they're smart, and they've got good ideas, and I learn a lot from them. So, and I want to say this real quick, and you know that from reading the book and from knowing me, I am not anti-big church in any way, shape, or form. I just simply think we need to be supporting small churches more than we have, that's all. But when you're at a bigger church and you're teaching from that, you're teaching from having had the minimum sample size. So if I'm pastoring a church of 2,000 and I'm hearing from a pastor of a church of 20,000, all I have to do is drop a zero, and I can virtually do everything they're doing by just dropping a zero because I'm at the minimum sample size. But if you go from 2,000 down to 200, you can't just drop a zero anymore, because you're not going to have all the same programs. You're not going to have the same systems. You don't need some of the things that a church of 2,000 is. And then when you drop from 200 down to 50, it's another animal again, because you can have two different groups of 50, churches of 50, and they are completely different from each other because it's a different 50 people in each church. So if you got a church of 50, one individual can either make or break your Sunday or make or break a particular ministry. But if you're pastoring a church to 2,000 or more, one or two people aren't going to have an impact on the whole. The minimum sample size kind of changes the way things are done. And so among large churches, they can share information very easily, and almost all of it overlaps. But even among small church pastors, when we share information, there's a certain section of it that isn't going to pass across because it's only going to apply to my church, because in my church is the only church that has the 50 people my church has.
So I want our listeners to keep that in mind, because I'm gonna ask you one more question, and then I'm gonna ask you some practical application type questions. And from when I get to those practical application questions, they need to know the law of large numbers, but they also need to have what I'm gonna talk to you about now in mind. And so let me ask you that. And you teach a lot of things in the book. I'm harping on two, and then we're going to three areas of application. So we have a law of large numbers is the first thing, but one of the other principles that you teach about is the need for a broader definition of church growth. Typically, as everybody knows, church growth means what has been somewhat colloquially called bottoms, buildings, and bucks.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's attendance, church building facilities, and dollar amount. And so if your numbers in those categories are going up and you're adding commas after the zeros, then that's good. That's considered church growth. And of course, that's not happening. That didn't happen in your experience. That doesn't happen in most small church pastors' experience. There's not this sort of exponential growth. There's, in some cases, there's not even arithmetic growth where you're just adding a few.
Right.
And so in looking at that, And in reassessing and saying, well, now what? You came to a different understanding or a broader definition of church growth than just numbers. And this is the way you put it in the book. We are always striving to increase our capacity for effective ministry. That's the way that your church talks about this. We are always striving to increase our capacity for effective ministry. So expand a little bit on that definition.
Yeah, the goal, we've always got to be, one of the primary jobs of leaders is to, first of all, define our reality, which is, okay, we're a small church, now what? That's the defining reality. But then one of the other premises of good leadership is to define a preferred future. Where is it that we're going? What are our actual goals? And the goal of a church is not just simply to have more people in the seats. The goal of a healthy church is to do effective ministry, to reach people, to minister to people, to bring souls into the kingdom, to disciple those that have been brought into the kingdom. And if we can do that more effectively, then we have a healthier church. And sometimes increasing our capacity for effective ministry might mean that we're going to be ministering in places that aren't necessarily going to put bottoms in the pews. That they might, we might, especially in today's day with social media and so on, we might be ministering to people who physically, geographically aren't close enough to our church to actually attend. And we have to look at that and go, but it is increasing our capacity for effective ministry. We are doing better ministry in our church. And we'll talk about this in a minute, if, and from the church as well. But if we're doing better ministry, then that's the goal. And so we have to look around and say, what can we do right now to increase our ability to do more effective ministry? And one of the big things, the big challenges for the small church is usually the pastor is the funnel through which everything has to go. And so the church growth people talk about this all the time, how, you know, the pastoral capacity is the cap on growth, but the pastoral capacity is also often a cap on effective ministry. If everything that happens in the church has to be thought of by me and promoted by me and set up by me and preached by me and cleaned up afterwards by me, then I'm going to limit this church's capacity to do effective ministry. But if I'm actually doing discipleship, if we're actually spending time equipping the saints to do ministry, which is the pastoral prime mandate, even most pastors don't realize that the word pastor, as far as the role, the title, is only mentioned in one place in the New Testament, in the book of Ephesians, along with, you know, the fivefold ministry, along with evangelist and prophet and teachers, and I'm always forgetting the fifth one.
Apostle,
thank you. And I always forget a different fifth one. So all those with the apostle gift, don't feel bad. Sometimes I forget the teacher. but yeah, those are the five, you know, ministry gifts that are supposed to be functioning in the church. And it's not that we're doing the work of ministry. We're supposed to be equipping the saints to do the work of ministry. So imagine in a church of 50, if it isn't just one pastor doing ministry for the 50, but it's all 50 doing ministry, talk about increasing your capacity for effective ministry. That's what a healthy small church looks like.
And so this is, I that was a great insight too. I mean, this book had so many aha moments for me, and I'm sure it will for other readers, and especially for, you know, anybody who is pastoring or has pastored a small church, you know, that the law of large numbers really helped explain things. This broader definition of church growth explains things. But, you know, at some point, you have to make it really, really concrete. And so three topics that I thought might be interesting. And you talk about a lot of different things in the book. So, I mean, the last half of the book really is filled with lots of practical application stuff. But the three things that really struck me were how small churches do vision casting, discipleship, and facilities differently than large churches. And so I want you to maybe expand on these three things. What is the difference in a small church as opposed to a large church in how a pastor casts vision?
Yeah, I mean, I've only been taught one way to cast vision, and it's pastor, go into the closet of prayer, get a vision from God. When you get that vision, go and sell the board and staff on it and make sure that they've bought into it, and then give them the job of making sure that the congregation understands that vision so everybody's on the same page. And when I look at Scripture, I see that pattern taking place, but I see it primarily in the Old Testament or in a church in crisis. It's what I call the prophet model of ministry. God speaks to the prophet speaks to the priests, and the priests get the people in line. I mean, the last third of the Old Testament is that it's God's through a prophet screaming at the priests, get your life back in line and get the people back in line, or you're going to be in trouble. But we've taken that Old Testament model, right, and here we are, especially as Pentecostals in the Assemblies of God, we've almost ignored how it completely shifted on the day of Pentecost. In Acts 2, it's not God speaking to Peter and Peter speaking to the disciples and the disciples speaking to the group, to the community. It's God speaking to the entire church as they're gathered. And then Acts 2:14 actually says, then Peter, with the 11, that Peter stood up with the 11, and it was a phrase I saw 10 years ago that was like one of these lightning bulb moments for me. Like, wait a minute, Peter didn't just speak up on his own or even under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. They gathered the leadership together on the day of Pentecost. And look it up. It's been there all along. Acts 2:14, Peter stood up with the 11 and addressed the crowd. So the model in the book of Acts is God speaks to the church and gives the church a word. And again, as good Pentecostals, we have to understand that the person in the pew has just as much access to hear from God as the person behind the pulpit. But sometimes we ignore that in the way we function as a church. So we listen to God together, and out of that, God calls leadership. And out of that leadership, God calls a spokesperson to make that declaration to the community. But when we're only doing the prophet model, God speaks to the person of God, and the person of God speaks to the leaders, and the leaders speak to the church, we miss that opportunity for God to speak to everybody. Now, in a huge church, you pretty much have to go with the prophet model. You can't be hearing from 2,000 or 5,000 people all at once. Otherwise, you're just taking surveys and it's just finger to the wind leadership, and that's not leadership. So in the bigger churches, it has to be a clear stated vision statement, because the pastor or even a pastor's direct representative is not going to be in the room for most of the ministries that the church is going to carry on. So the vision statement keeps everybody on the same page of the mission. So that makes sense from a big church context. But the smaller the church is, the more opportunity we have, especially as Pentecostals, to actually sit and say, what is God speaking to you today? Where is God leading you? What is your vision? And as a pastor, I'll often have those conversations, and somebody will say, the Lord is leading me to such and such, but I don't know how to do this. And then I'll go, oh, wait a minute. A week ago, I had a conversation with so-and-so, and God is leading them to do such and such. But if we put their desire to go here and your desire to do it that way together, your administrative call and their vision call comes together, we can do something wonderful. And the Lord puts us in the position where we can actually help people see their vision come to fruition. And as pastors, we can, it's like being a chef and putting all these wonderful ingredients together and coming up with something better than we could have thought of ourselves, because we're starting with the ingredients God gave us. It's a completely different way of looking at vision. And it's not that the other one is bad. It's simply that the other one only functions, from what I can tell, in a really large church or in a church in crisis. But in a smaller, healthy church, we can be much more collaborative in the way we see vision and move forward with God's plan for the church.
Yeah, I mean, as a pastor, you know, if I stood up on a Sunday morning and looked at 100 people and I said, now, I know you've been doing this for a while. I'm new to the church, whatever, but this is what we're doing. So get on board or get off. They would have left, or more likely they would have booted me. It is a far more collaborative thing, because in larger churches, because of the law of large numbers, you have systems and processes. But in smaller churches, you have relationships, and things have to be done more relationally, which brings me to the second point. And this is related to that difference between systems and processes and relationship. And that's the issue of discipleship. How do you disciple people in a small church context, as opposed to how it's done in a big church?
It's one of the things that I'm asked probably more than anything else is, do you have a curriculum that you recommend for discipleship in a small church? And my answer is, yeah, pretty much any of them. I don't mean to be dismissive, but basically, if it works for you, it works for you. But my primary focus on it is this: don't lean on the curriculum. Jesus didn't have curriculum. The Apostle Paul didn't have curriculum. But they both used the most effective discipleship program ever devised, which is mentoring. And in a small church, we don't have to mentor, we get to mentor. The main reason we have curriculum, and I'm grateful for curriculum, it's very helpful. But the main reason we have curriculum is for two reasons. One, if the group is too large to mentor, then you've got to go to a teaching curriculum. Or two, as a mentoring tool to make sure that you're staying within the theological guardrails and to make sure that you're keeping out a particular calendar so you're not spending forever on one point and getting lost in the bushes and, you know, chasing rabbits down holes. So curriculum can be helpful, but in a bigger church, curriculum is usually the main thing that's done, and mentoring might happen as a byproduct of that. But in a smaller church, mentoring should be our primary focus for discipleship, and use curriculum to supplement that to give us good theological guardrails and to give us a good timeline for it. But we shouldn't concentrate on the curriculum. We should concentrate on mentoring, because the primary way that people grow in their faith is not by completing a class. It's by getting to know a believer who's further down the road in their faith than they are. And that's what mentoring does.
You know, for instance, this was an interesting thing, a statement that you made in the book, and I have some experience in this, because when I was associate pastor, I was an associate pastor at a very large church. And so we used a variation of Rick Warren's purpose-driven church model, what you call it the base path model, you know, 101, 201, 301, 401. So we used that, and that was real good for new members, and then we would put them into small groups. And you made two funny comments that stood out to me on this topic. Is one is that you took your whole church to the base path model, and then everybody was done, and there wasn't anybody else to do it the next year, because your church wasn't growing explosively like it was supposed to according to church growth theories. But the other thing is that, in a large church, people are constantly, the systems and processes are designed to move people from a large group Sunday experience to a mid-sized group curriculum experience to an ongoing weekly small group experience. But in a small group, you already are in a small church. You already are a small group. And so there may be less of a need to have a small groups ministry or that particular form. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, but I mean, that was also one of the interesting things you said in the book.
For years, we tried to do small groups and it didn't work until I realized, because I guess we are one, really. So what I kind of noticed was, particularly where I live in very, very busy Orange County, if people are, the regular committed churchgoer used to go three times a week, and now the regular committed churchgoer goes three times a month. That's happening across the board and cross-denominationally in the United States. So if that's happening in your church, yes, it's cause for concern, but it's what's typically happening. So we're at a point now where people are busy, their lives are changed, they just don't have the time or whatever reasons for it to attend that often. So what we looked at we realized if people are going to come and they're going to give me that chunk of time on a Sunday morning, and if I'm going to ask for them to give a second chunk of their time in the week, I need to give them something that they're not already getting in a Sunday morning. Now, if you're going to a big church, on Sunday morning, you're getting teaching and you're getting worship, but you're not getting fellowship. So the small group provides that third thing that they're not getting on a Sunday morning. But in a small church, I'm getting teaching and I'm getting worship and I'm getting fellowship on Sunday morning. So if we're going to ask people for a second chunk of their time during the week, we need to offer them something that they're not already getting on Sunday morning. And the one thing they can't get on Sunday morning is the opportunity to do outside the walls ministry. So we went through a long season in our church where we didn't have quote unquote small groups. But what we told people was, if you want to spend another chunk of your time in the week doing something with the church people, join this ministry team that goes down and feeds the homeless. Join this team that goes to the house where we work with abused women and children. Help out at the high school with Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Don't just spend another chunk of your time hanging out with Christians again, but let's do something of value for the community. So that was what we did for a season. Our small groups were all ministry teams because that added one more important piece of their church life that they could not get on Sunday morning.
So the last thing that I think is really helpful for small church pastors is the question of facilities. How do you use facilities? The church that I pastored had at one point been a much larger church. And so I had massive facilities, but they weren't full. And so we ended up finding different ways to collaborate some with other churches in the areas who had people but not facilities. So we rented our facilities during the weekends and did some other stuff. But that's probably not the problem most small church pastors have. They have the opposite problem. They probably have small facilities or no facilities. So how do you make the best use of the facility?
Yeah, that's exactly our problem. We are very, very landlocked. We have a very tiny footprint. And so we're trying to have an impact that's bigger than our footprint. And the first decision that we started making when we realized we're going to do our best with our small church, what does a healthy small church look like, was, okay, if we're going to require that all of the ministry of this church gets done on this property, then talk about putting a cap on ministry. I mean, you know, for instance, we've talked about Rick Warren because he's right here in Orange County, but I've been to Saddleback Church many, many, many times. Saddleback Church isn't a church. It's a city practically. I mean, they don't have a kids department. They have a kids village. It's massive. And yet, if Saddleback Church was to limit the ministry they did to their physical building, they would be limiting what God could do because their physical facility is not big enough to do everything God is calling them to do. Because no physical facility can hold God's plans for us. It's got to go out from there. So we use a phrase at our church that we call, we've got to do ministry from the church, not just in the church. And we're always asking ourselves, what does that look like for us to do ministry from the church, not just in the church? Is there an opportunity to do ministry that is out there in the community that may, in fact, not even bring people in? If it does bring people in, great. We're always wanting to do that. We're always inviting people. We're on a big emphasis right now at our church about inviting people in and bringing them into the house. We want that to happen. But if a ministry comes along that isn't necessarily going to put bottoms in the pews, we're not going to say no to it. But too often we do that. Too often our entire church growth thought process is getting more people in the building. And that's when we start idolizing the building. We make an idol out of the facility rather than understanding that the mission is always bigger than the building. So we've got a ministry from the church, not just in the church. Secondly, one of the big principles I learned was most of our churches, especially if you're a small church pastor and you haven't started the church and you're not the church planter. Jesus started the church. That's the incorrect phrase. None of us have started the church. But if you're not a church planter, but you're coming to an existing church,
right,
you are likely in a facility that was built in a previous era when people went to church and expected different things of the church than they expect today. That's our church is that way. Our church building is over 50 years old. And back then, people expected different things of the church than they expect today. They came to church in a different way. Everything about it was different. And so we've got this facility that we need to adapt to the new ways that people do things. I call it hauling rocks in a Volkswagen. And the illustration I like to use is imagine that you've been given the job of hauling rocks. And the only vehicle you've been given is a Volkswagen Beetle. And so in a Volkswagen Beetle, the only way you're going to do this, and it's got to be the new school Volkswagen Beetle with the engine up front, because I've had people catch me on this before. Imagine you got to haul rocks in this Volkswagen Beetle. You got one of two ways of doing it. You can take the rocks one at a time and gingerly place them on the back seat that's been covered with packing blankets and maybe haul two or three rocks at a time. Or you can cut the back end off. You can put a pickup bed in the back of it. You can reinforce the shocks. You can dump rocks and you can start hauling rocks. In a lot of our buildings, we need to do that. We need to look at the building and go, okay, we're called to haul rocks. How are we going to do that in this little Volkswagen Beetle? How do we need to change our facility so that we're putting people ahead of the building? I will sacrifice the building for people any day, but I will not sacrifice the building for people. And we've got to figure out ways often to simply adapt our building to the new needs. If we're demanding that people behave themselves in a building for a certain way because we're worried about staining the carpet, we will limit the amount of ministry we can do in our building.
So I've been talking to Carl Vaders about his new book, Small Church Essentials. Subtitle is Field-Tested Principles for Leading a Healthy Congregation of Under 250. This is just out from Moody Publishers. Carl, if pastors want to connect with you online because they're interested in learning more about effective small church leadership, how do they do that?
Yeah, my website is newsmallchurch.com, newsmallchurch.com. I blog for Christianity Today, but the URL to find that is more complicated. So if you go to newsmallchurch.com, click on any of the articles there, That will take you immediately to the blog at Christianity Today. And from there, you can email me, or you can follow me on Twitter at Carl Vaders and Instagram at Carl Vaders, or on Facebook at New Small Church.
Okay. Thanks for joining me on the Influence Podcast today, Carl.
You got it, George. Good to be with you.
This has been the Influence Podcast, a collection of inspiring and challenging conversations aimed at empowering the entire spectrum of church leadership. Visit influencemagazine.com/podcast to see our growing library of podcasts with Christian leaders. Make sure to like, review, and share them with your friends. Until the next podcast, may God continue to bless you richly today and every day.